Hello and welcome to Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name's Lewis Webb, and each week I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. This season, we'll also be showcasing some of the area's musical talent, with tracks from local artists being played in each podcast. In this episode, we'll hear from a band which came together during the pandemic, Young Martyrs. As ever, your comments, reviews and feedback are always appreciated. And if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week spent 25 years working in the corporate and media world before a build-up of stress brought her to realise her calling in emotional freedom and wellness. Amanda Forster-Searle is a practitioner of integrative health, looking at how nutrition, mental health, negative experiences and energy levels all affect each other in our mind and body. We chatted over Zoom last month, covering everything from toxic workplaces to an obscure piece of late 90s nostalgia, the Y2K bug. Amanda, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Hello, nice to be here.
You are based over by the coast in Limpsham.
I am, yes. It's literally 3 miles to the coast of Breen, so not far at all.
Very nice. How were your daily walks during lockdown? Did you kind of get out and about, or was it always to the beach?
You know what? We actually did quite a bit of cycling, actually, for our exercise, because Limpsham's really near the cycle path. So you can go basically towards Weston or towards Breen, and it's all off-road. So we did quite a lot of that, and it was lovely, because obviously it was quite empty. So we weren't battling for space, which was, a bonus.
So I know Limpsham, small village, but what would be your recommendations for, you know, 24 hours in and around your area, your neck of the woods?
I think it's lucky, because actually you're very near the M5, but far enough away, you know, not to sort of hear it. So actually you've got Weston and Burnham-on-Sea, which are very different. Weston is obviously a lot busier normally. Burnham is kind of more old-fashioned sort of seafront town, which is lovely. But then we're literally sort of 30 minutes or so to Glastonbury and sort of Wells. And we can even kind of hop over to Bath within sort of an hour and 20 minutes. So there's so much. And even on a weekend, we might actually go to places like Dunster or Minehead, because that's literally, well, I think it takes about 45 minutes. So it feels really central. There's a lot of choice, kind of depending on weather and whether you want coast or woodlands. I think it's quite lucky, actually.
We'll talk a little bit about this later, but you are a presenter on a radio station. So
I am.
You'll be very used to recording audio, microphones, all that sort of gubbins.
Yeah, I would hope so. Yes, no, it's been a learning curve this last sort of 6 to 8 months, but I really enjoy it.
You were telling me before we started recording that your sort of life growing up was dotted around the country and also around the world as well. Can you give me a picture as to what that was like?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I've lived in quite a number of places. I was originally born in the Lake District. And then from the age of 3 to 4, grew up in Buckinghamshire, and then moved to Oxfordshire, which then took a big, big jump, and we moved down to Cornwall, which was beautiful. And then my husband was had a job in Abu Dhabi, so we spent some time there in Dubai, and then we came and landed in Somerset and been here just over 2 years.
Going back to then your sort of time growing up, the Lake District, Buckinghamshire, as you mentioned, what was family life like?
It was based in the country, so I grew up. The Buckinghamshire part, obviously, I remember more because I was slightly older. It's a village kind of on the outskirts of London, I would say now. When I was growing up, it didn't seem like that. But obviously, I think as time's gone on, the suburbs of London have sort of moved further out. But it was a lovely village with a little duck pond. And I can remember it had quite a few little shops then and things. So it was a nice place to grow up. There was a lot of time spent in the fields and by the river. So I think being in the countryside has definitely been part of my life throughout, to be honest.
Is it a big family that you're part of?
No, there's only me, no siblings, and quite a big family, sort of cousins and everything else. But again, really bizarre, but we're all split all over the world, from America to Australia to France. So we don't actually get together that often, which is a shame.
But growing up, you didn't have anyone to share the bread with when you're feeding the ducks at the duck pond. It was all
just about you. Me and my mum most of the time. So yeah, I held the bag of bread.
What kind of interests did you have as a child?
I used to do dancing. I was in the Brownies, and I also did some like amateur dramatics and stuff. So I think I do remember being quite a shy child, but whether it was through choice or my parents kind of trying to get me more confident to do all these things, I do remember enjoying it a lot and sort of doing dancing exams. So quite a normal girl's upbringing, I would say, probably.
So ducks and dancing.
Yeah, ducks and dancing. Yeah, good combination.
A bit of Swan Lake, maybe.
Yeah, probably wasn't that good.
You mentioned being maybe a little shy as a child. Were you maybe quite observant and attuned to other people's emotions? Have you always been naturally empathetic?
Do you know what? I think looking back, I have, because I can remember as a child always kind of almost sitting on the periphery and sort of weighing up, you know, a room, if you like, of friends or classmates or whatever, and trying to kind of suss where I felt the best from. So I think now I would see that as kind of feeling like whether somebody was giving off positive energy or whether there was a lot of negativity around. So I think, yeah, I think I did. But obviously when I was younger, didn't really realise, you know, that's how I was thinking.
And while you were growing up, was your family one that paid much attention to that sort of holistic approach to health? So, you know, not just what you do, but also nutrition and sort of mental well-being as well?
No, to be honest, my father worked most of his life in the pharmaceutical industry. So we always kind of led a healthy lifestyle as far as, you know, decent food, and my dad would exercise a lot. But no, I didn't grow up sort of with any holistic influences as such in my childhood. No, not at all. I think my mum's mum was, she would kind of be quite cagey about it, but I think she enjoyed the fact that she believed she had seen ghosts and all that kind of stuff. But that was probably about as close as it got.
Did you believe her?
I did, yeah, because the stories she told were quite compelling. And I think my mum always used to kind of like frown all that she was spinning a story, but who knows, it sounded true.
You also have that sort of unquestioning belief of people in your family that you trust, whereas it's quite easy for grandparents to tell fibs and for young kids to believe them, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think, obviously, I've been a mum now for 12 years, and I think, yeah, I've realised how you can spin the truth a little bit sometimes.
A little older then, and as a teenager, teenage life is notoriously full of emotional roller coasters. Mm-hmm. Were you quite self-aware of what you were going through in terms of your mind, body at the time?
I don't ever remember having any sort of key drama around that time. I had a very close network of girlfriends at school, and we were quite sort of open and supportive of each other, but it doesn't, I think my mum would probably say something different. I do remember arguments with my mother, and as my daughter now is nearly 13, I can kind of vouch for that as well from my side. But I could, yeah, other than that, and kind of, I guess, being a bit moody and stuff, I don't remember anything quite really dramatic.
Yeah, finally, when you have to sort of be on the other side of the argument with your children, when you realise, oh yeah, maybe they were right.
Yeah, exactly. I try to stop myself sounding like my mother, but it comes out every now and then.
And what ambitions did you have? What did you sort of want to be and do when you were grown up?
It's funny. When I was, you know, when you make your choices as like subjects, I didn't really know, but I knew that I had a passion for cooking and nutrition at the time. And I did sort of exams and those kind of studies, but then just, I don't know, even can't even tell you to this day where it came from, but when I left sixth form, I'd done business studies, And that completely changed. I think I was at one point wanting to go into hotel management. And then a job came up at the BBC and I took it and I was there for 13 years. So I never did go into the hotel side, but then the nutrition part came into play, obviously, later on.
You started your professional life, as you mentioned, not as a wellness professional, but at the BBC.
Yes. Very
much behind the scenes, though.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit about your time there?
Yeah, it was, I have to say, in my corporate life, if I can call it that, it was the best years. So I worked in the copyright department predominantly. So I was responsible for clearing the rights for people to use images on TV programmes. And then I moved back in, gosh, when would it have been, 1998. And it was literally when the internet was kind of just really kicking off. And I was involved in the BBC's first website and I had to negotiate contracts for kind of talent and footballers and all that kind of thing to put stuff on the website. So it was an exciting time.
Yeah, the whole media industry around that time was dealing with the emergence of the internet. Do you remember the feeling of excitement around what was then a brand new form of media?
Absolutely. It honestly felt as though we were sort of just spearheading something new because it, you know, never been done before. And I was involved in not only the first website, but then when broadband came into play, it was then, oh my goodness, we can put like videos on the internet. And it was all much more rich media, which was hugely exciting because everyone was then thinking of all these amazing things that they could do.
Did you have to deal with the Y2K bug?
Thankfully, no, but I do remember. I do remember when that was all, up in the air and everyone was panicking, coming in after, the millennium and wondering whether their computer was going to self-combust. And
yeah, that was a strange, not really a hoax, I suppose.
No, but it was bizarre, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was sort of either it's going to be fine or the entire system around the world of computers are just going to stop.
It's just going to crash, yeah.
And we'll be plunged into the dark ages.
I know. I do remember it.
Looking back on it, I think it's a hilarious thing. There's probably a good, what's it called, like a kind of mockumentary about that.
There must be.
That could be done, you know, in the style of like the W1A.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, totally.
Do you watch that?
I haven't seen it, but I've heard of it. Yeah, okay. I haven't seen any episodes, but I have heard of it. I must go and do that. Go and look at it.
I always wonder what people who have spent time at the BBC think about, you know, when they portray it in such a kind of
there's been so many series over the years, though, which have taken kind of a mocked approach. But I've got lots of stories to tell about famous people, and it was in the real glory days, I think, because you look at it now, it's changed so much. Well, the whole broadcasting, I was actually based at Television Centre, so the whole broadcasting industry has just been so diluted and kind of spread out now. It's very different.
What's your favourite of those stories then?
I think it would be two things that just stand out. One was for the France World Cup 1998. We were doing the website for it and they had, I can't remember his character's name, but Arthur Bostrom from Allo Allo that spoke about the big Madonna and everything. Can't think of his character's name. Anyhow, he did a little paragraph for all the different venues in France. And they asked me to do the voiceover to be the posh English person. So I had to sit in a recording studio with him, recording in my really posh English accent, whilst he did the comical French take on everything. And then another one, I think, was, again, it was for sport. I can't remember what event it was, but it was cricket. And Geoffrey Boycott, who I think everyone realises is quite renowned for having a temper, had an argument with me down the phone, which was interesting. But yeah, I've had a lot of experiences, shall we say.
Did you kind of embrace the new technologies as well, sort of personally as well as professionally?
Yeah, it was, you know, you had to. You was just kind of, because actually when I left the BBC, I went to BT for a while, and then I was involved in a startup internet company called FreeServe that some people may remember, and I worked there. So again, I was doing business development for them. So I can remember when FreeServe gave us this little box, and it was actually to get the internet on your television screen. And we thought, you know, it was cutting edge. It was incredible. And so we all were able to take these little boxes home to try it out on our TV. But yeah, when you look back, it's just incredible how things have progressed. You know, you wouldn't even have fathomed probably half the stuff that we can do now.
Yeah, I mean, FreeServe would have been, what, 2001? Something like that?
Yeah, 2000, 2001, yeah.
Yeah, and who'd have thought that, you know, only, what, 7-8 years later, you'd have the iPhone?
I know. It's crazy, isn't it? Things have just, yeah, when you think what's happened in a short time, you know, and like here we are on Zoom calls and stuff now, it's amazing, really.
Around that time, the early 2000s, internet companies were pretty intense places to be, as well as fun.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of hard work. Did you give any consideration to how that might have been affecting your own health and well-being at the time?
I do remember, because I had quite a long commute, because I was living in Oxfordshire, and I had to commute into central London. The long commute was very draining. And back then, although I worked from home, I think it was probably one day a week, there it was really not kind of the thing, because in media, it was still very much that kind of atmosphere that people were there, that their life was the media. So it was weird when you were seen sort of leaving because you had like a 2-hour journey home, or you were working from home. And I do remember it did feel very draining at times, but there was never any of the focus on wellness or kind of how, what's the word, flexible working. None of that was really considered in such a big way then.
And do you feel that even with those pressures from the sort of professional environment around you, did you feel you were looking after yourself properly?
Yeah, I tried to. I mean, I even though it was a long day for the days that I was commuting, I did kind of make sure that with the minute I got on the train, I tried to switch off, and I'd read my book, and I'd go to the gym on the way home sometimes as well. So there was a lot of focus on kind of looking after myself, definitely. But I think probably the early starts of like getting up at 5:30 every day probably took their toll eventually.
Talk me through how you came to the realization that environment wasn't one that was right for you, and wasn't one that you were, you know, really thriving in.
So after FreeServe, I moved to another company out of London, and I had a really good few years there. And then what happened, and it was a very high pressure job because I was a commercial manager, but they acquired another company, and I was kind of put in place to expose risks to our company. But when I actually delivered the results I'd found, I realized that I wasn't going to be supported by my manager. And it was at that point when things really changed, because the whole dynamics of a good team structure and support just seemed to kind of crumble around me.
How did you process that sort of mentally?
Gosh, I think now I was struggling for a while. I was kind of working on autopilot, and I was just trying to do my job. But I can remember Sunday nights, I would, you know, have those moments of even being in tears, like the thought of going into work that week. And ultimately, I couldn't tell you how long that went on for, but ultimately I did literally just break down after coming back from holiday, after a couple of weeks, and I just, yeah, it broke me basically, and I couldn't go back in.
Was that more of a build up then of all of the anxiety that has sort of been coming to a point, rather than a single confrontation or event that brought it to a head?
Yeah, definitely. I think, and now that I know because of what I've gone on to study, this is often what happens is that they'll the pivotal event that actually kind of ends you just thinking, that's it, I can't take anymore, may actually be something quite insignificant, but it's that complete build up and it's almost like the last straw. So the actual event itself wasn't anything dramatic. It was just a long period of time of being under severe stress.
Did you have a realization that it wasn't just that job that was doing this to you, but it was the corporate world as a whole? Or did you think, actually, if I just find another company to do the same thing, I'll be fine?
I think because of the way I felt I was treated and because of the way I felt, you know, I suffered with depression and anxiety, I couldn't actually see at that moment in time that anywhere else would be any different. I think it had clouded my judgment, that, you know, anywhere else would be the same.
What process did you go through to realize what you needed to do next?
Well, I was signed off by the doctors, and in a very kind of in a quick summary, the company was negligent in a few areas, but it came to that point where I could have faced a long, you know, court legal battle, and I chose for my own sort of mental health at that point to just walk away. So after 13 years, I just left. And at that point, I thought, gosh, what do I do now? Because I wasn't strong enough really to consider, like you've just said, you know, going somewhere else. And I actually made me think, do you know what? I actually want to do something more worthwhile. And I thought long and hard, and kind of the nutrition part came up for me first. And I thought, well, actually, I probably could do with training and learning something to take my mind off, but also help in my recovery. So I decided to study nutrition and really focused on that, not really knowing at that point where it was going to take me. But soon after, I kind of came to that decision that actually what I wanted to focus on moving towards was to actually be able to help people avoid going through what I went through.
Young Martyrs are a four-piece guitar-driven band featuring a friend of the podcast, Tom Corneill. Along with Lee, Rich and Simon, the band came together and recorded their first tracks last year over months of lockdown and social distancing. This year, they'll be performing at Summerstock and a few more festivals. And from their self-titled debut album, this is Just the End of Summer.
Thank you. When you talk about that experience, having been in a position where you're A, not supported professionally, but B, even when that is raised, it's not dealt with in a way that is doing the right thing by you. I would imagine that a lot of people who go through something similar are maybe not aware, or maybe sort of too in the groove of, well, this is my career, this is what I do, and wouldn't necessarily think to put themselves in a position where they might be able to retrain or do something different. Does that just come down to, in your opinion, the habit of people sort of identifying themselves with their professional roles?
Absolutely, because to be honest, I think if I'd had a better outcome of what I went through, who knows whether I'd still be there, to be honest, because although I've always been kind of that person that people would come and talk to, even in the kitchen at work, you know, if they were having a bad day, people kind of just seemed to gravitate towards me, if they were struggling. But I think people do, they almost can't see themselves doing anything else, or there is sometimes that kind of fear factor of change. You know, nobody really likes change, but sometimes I think when you're put in a position where you have to change, which is out of your control, that then gives people the push to think, oh, well, actually, you know, I could do something different now, and people become more open to other opportunities.
I think we'll probably talk about this a little bit in a few minutes, but I guess one of the things which puts you at an advantage in what you do now is that you have been through that professional, like corporate element of your career. So you're able to relate to people who are sort of in similar positions. You know, it's not like you've been doing the world of wellness and well-being all your life. You have firsthand experience of, I guess, what we would call now sort of toxic workplace culture and what that can actually do to people.
Totally. And, you know, I say this all the time because I think, you know, I had people, clients in the past that would say, oh, but, you know, you're a well-being coach, or you're, you know, mental health coach. How could you possibly know what it's like? And again, you know, I freely share my story because I think it is good for people to understand that I do know. I did the commute. I did the traveling with work. I had, you know, awkward bosses and all of this kind of stuff, which are all everyday occurrences for most people, that I do get it. And that's why I'm so passionate about kind of making a difference, not only to help people avoid going through it, but obviously supporting them, you know, if they are going through something as well.
Do you miss any of that world?
I don't miss being on the inside, but I do enjoy the interaction I have sometimes now with sort of helping small businesses, because that's one area that I tend to focus on, not the big corporate giants, because obviously they're kind of wieldy beasts and they have their own, you know, employee assistance programs and stuff. But I do enjoy helping small businesses because I think sometimes they get overlooked. And obviously anybody that's an employee deserves to have support. So I do enjoy kind of getting back and interacting, you know, in those environments.
By the time you decided to retrain, there must have been quite a number of options available. It wasn't sort of the very, very early days of wellness being an industry, I suppose. Did you feel drawn to a particular area or discipline within that?
Definitely. I think to start with, I really focused on nutrition because I saw that as one of the key things that often people overlook, and it has such a big part to play, you know, with their mindset and obviously sort of physical symptoms. But what I found was when I started seeing clients sort of, you know, giving nutritional coaching, quite often it wasn't just about the nutrition. Yes, there may have been areas that they could improve their diet, and there may have been things that I was helping with gut health and all of that kind of stuff. But every single time, what I was finding, there was an emotional part to it as well. So with obviously what I'd been through, I decided then to focus on stress and the effects that stress have on the mind and the body, because that was a natural progression, linking sort of everything together. And what I've then sort of gone on to do is to kind of study different tools, because my philosophy is the more tools you can have in your toolkit, the more chance you have to help yourself. And if you look at the whole of you, sort of, so your mental, emotional and physical as well, you've got a much better chance of supporting yourself and sort of fixing something that's not, you know, functioning quite right, if you look at it from all angles.
And did you have a good idea of where to start and where to find those tools?
Do you know what? There is so much out there. I mean, obviously, as we've said, with the internet, you can find absolutely anything about everything. So it was more a case of what I felt I was drawn to when I did research. And then obviously, you know, you sort of read recommendations, and I started to join the dots together. So the other tools that I've kind of been led to study are things like CBT and EFT, which is emotional freedom technique, or tapping, people may know of. And all of these things work differently, but they are kind of very similar in their kind of underpinning. But for me, it's all about the mindset. And even that comes down to nutrition. If we get the mindset right and the emotional side balanced, everything kind of, you know, progresses from that. So even someone's addictions with foods or whatever that might look like can really be helped if the mindset is in a better place first.
So EFT is a new one for me. It's not something I've heard about. Mm. What's the thinking and the process behind that one?
So they nickname EFT sort of psychological acupuncture, because basically you use a technique of tapping on different points, sort of on the side of the hand and on the face, which are connected to acupressure points. So it works very similarly in things like acupuncture or reflexology, but it's working with the emotional side of the brain. So you use it to sort of release trauma. You can use it to help people that have had past things in their life that they want to kind of let go of. So it's very useful as more of a tool, rather than necessarily having to put someone through a sort of painful emotional talking therapy, which for a lot of people, you know, can put them off because it's too raw and they don't necessarily want to talk about things in great detail. So it really helps to shift thought patterns, you know, whilst working on certain conditions and sort of certain things in people's lives.
And so during that training, I suppose, and going through learning some of those techniques to help people heal emotionally and mentally, did that bring to the surface some of your own past experiences and stresses?
Yeah, I mean, I've realized throughout this whole journey that, you know, I think any one of us, we are still all kind of evolving, and we sometimes can find that there are triggers that we thought were long buried for things that have happened in our past that we perhaps hadn't dealt with. Because normally what happens is you either deal with it at the time or you bury it, and then you put something else on top and something else on top. And sometimes it can be years before something triggers a reaction that makes you realize, oh gosh, actually, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. So yeah, there were times through my training that I was using the technique on myself to, you know, to heal sort of some of the triggers that came up from things in the past, definitely.
So to that extent, I suppose you became your own first client.
Yes, yeah. I mean, and again, I do feel it was part of my kind of own self-healing journey by doing the studies I did to get me through, you know, what I went through, but to come out the other side not only stronger myself, but then able to help other people do the same thing.
Was there anything that you went into and, you know, started picking up that you felt, actually, I'm not quite sure this works for me, or I'm not quite sure I buy into this as a technique and as a theory?
Yeah, I kind of got led to sort of one side with the more sort of holistic spiritual side of things. So I am a trained Reiki master as well. And whilst I do believe that, you know, the energy is all around us, and I do believe in all of that, what I found was it's not for everybody. And what I realized was I didn't want to go down that path to the extent that I was not able to then help more people, because people need to be need to feel comfortable, need to be open with the, you know, the modalities that you use. And I think it just occurred to me that actually it's something that a lot of people question because they don't understand it. And so that for me is still part of my own personal life, but I chose not to carry it on as far as offering it to people.
You describe your approach, which I suppose is a little bit multidimensional, as integrative wellness.
Yes.
Have you found there to be a growing interest in that as a space rather than, I think, you know, people dipping into a bit of yoga here, a bit of nutrition over here?
Yeah, I think predominantly it's because, you know, obviously there is still a huge part for medicine. And I think what people are realizing that really should be for almost like critical care because it's absolutely needed. But in the last few years, especially what I've noticed that people are taking more ownership for their own health and therefore realizing that, you know, if you're just going to a yoga class once a week, but you're eating a really bad diet, you're not going to be really helping yourself on all levels. And I think people are understanding more as well about sort of lifestyle diseases like type 2 diabetes and obesity and things like that, and that we have to take ownership. You know, we have to try what we can do to look after ourselves first and foremost.
For the people who come to you, not asking for specific examples, but what's a typical journey in terms of the work that you do together?
What I do initially is I will always invite somebody to have like a half hour call with me for free to start with, because I think it's important that they kind of resonate with what I do, and also that I feel I can really help them. So I would never kind of get someone to pay for that initial sort of short session. And then we would work together. And I think I've seen most of my clients, and that be corporate ones and individuals, I would say stress is involved in nearly every one of them, because stress is on all different levels. You know, it might be stress of having a newborn baby, or it could be stress from work, or it could be stress because you're looking after aging parents. There are so many different things throughout our lives that can cause elements of stress. That obviously the digestive system, for instance, takes a huge hit, because if we're in that kind of fight or flight or freeze mode, digestion kind of goes on the back burner. And that's when people start realizing that, or perhaps they need to see a nutritionist. But actually, when you start to unpick, you can see what's been causing it from the start and where, therefore, we need to start on their journey to kind of getting them back to feeling stronger.
I wanted to touch a little bit on the last year or so and the pressure it's put on people around the country. How have you seen that display itself in the people that you talk to?
I think there's a lot more anxiety from people, for sure. I think people's worlds in some shape or form, because what's that saying? We're not all in the same boat. We're in the same storm, but we're in different boats. Some people are in cruise liners and others are in a blow up dinghy. You know, that's the kind of thing that the whole pandemic has given everybody. And I think anxiety around the future, anxiety, there's been a huge more amount of social anxiety. And I think that's actually the most worrying one for me going forward, because I think it's something especially that is going to stay even as things, you know, we come out of lockdown even more, because people have suddenly been thrown out of their comfort zone. You know, they've stayed at home more and they may not have been an overly social person beforehand. But now it's caused almost the reverse. It's caused issues. So I think, yeah, stress, anxiety and social anxiety especially have been the key things that have arisen, I think, in this last year.
Something else that I know has been a struggle for a lot of people has been sleep and the effects of not sleeping well. Do you think it's the anxiety that's behind that? What else are you sort of seeing that's causing that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously problems with sleep can be caused by a number of different things. But anxiety and sort of raised cortisol levels and your adrenaline kind of continually firing is definitely one that stops the kind of the relaxing brain which is what you want when you go to sleep, because then this kind of overthinking mind kicks in. When we have periods of quiet, and that's obviously when you've got into bed and you're tired and you want to go to sleep, the overthinking brain kicks in. And it's the mind chatter that I think has caused a lot of people problems. But equally, I think, again, because people have been out of routine, people have been going to bed later, or they've been on devices more because we've not been able to go anywhere. So, you know, obviously these, the sort of the light from the phones is not good. If you're obviously drinking alcohol or caffeine sort of late of an evening, that's not going to help with sleep either. And I think people's routine has been key, because love it or hate it, when you are going out to work, you have a set routine because you have to get up at a certain time. You might have to catch a train. And because all of that went, people's routines just went out the window. And sleep, good sleep, comes from good routine. Again, you know, one of the key things I say to people, and not everyone likes it, is we do benefit from going to bed at the same time and trying to get up at the same time. And if you then don't have that routine, you're not going to necessarily get yourself up at 6 a.m. because you think there's no point. So I think, yeah, there's been huge, huge different factors that have contributed in poor sleep for a lot of people.
It's funny, isn't it, that as a parent, you stress the importance of routine. Mm. And when routine isn't in place and it manifests itself in various ways, you understand that.
Yes.
But then you feel like, well, I'm a grown-up, so I don't need a routine.
Yeah.
And then, so at what point, you know, at what point do you qualify for the ability to just throw that out the window?
I know. And I think we've all done it. You know, we all think, like you said, we're adults. Oh, we can cope. It's fine. We don't need 8 hours sleep. It's, you know, but actually we do. And in fact, I think because as parents, especially if you're working as well, you're juggling so many different hats and have constantly got things on your mind that it's even more difficult for us to switch off. Whereas children, predominantly, they're tired, they're knackered by the time it comes to bed, even though they might, you know, try and stay up a bit later. They actually give into it because their body just knows how much they need it. And yet we don't. We don't learn these lessons, you know, as we've got older, and we kind of try to do everything, which is when it causes problems.
We are now at a point where there is light at the end of the tunnel, I suppose, from a COVID and lockdown perspective. What advice would you give to people for whom the last year has been a trauma in the truest sense of the world? Or similarly, you mentioned those people who are suffering anxiety about what happens next.
I think I would say speak to people. You know, if you are facing going back to the office, for instance, and you do feel as though you're, you know, feeling quite anxious about that, do speak up. Even if it's not to somebody like your manager, but speak to somebody, because, you know, companies, the bigger companies, are being a lot more open to what has gone on, and, you know, have put sort of, some of them have put in some really good wellbeing programs. If you work for a small company, then again, you know, hiding stuff is not good. So talk to someone, and if you need to see somebody, then there is absolutely nothing wrong with that, because, you know, so many people have been struggling in the same way, and actually sharing how you're feeling can be the first step to sort of you feeling better.
For some people, living lives that have been a little bit more basic has changed how they think about stress and anxiety for the better. What's your take on that?
No, I agree. I think people, like you say, on the flip side, have actually found the not having to rush around, the kind of the simpler, quieter life, actually, you know, more beneficial. And, you know, I've heard so many people kind of turn to different hobbies and got themselves off the TV and off their phones and stuff. So I think there are, you know, although we hear a lot of negatives around this last year, I think there's been a lot of positives to come out of it as well.
Do you think that that will continue? Do you think that sort of movement of, as you say, you know, people wanting to reconnect with hobbies that are more tactile and you know, experiences that are less about being online, do you think that will continue after after things return to a degree of normality?
I hope so. I really do hope so, because I think, you know, a lot of people I've spoken to have said that they found a lot more joy in sort of a walk in the woods and sort of, you know, listening to a podcast like we're doing. But actually, I guess when, you know, we've seen it all already in the last few weeks, once people are able to sort of move around more freely or completely freely, I think there will be a period of time when some people will kind of go mad for all that they're able to do now, and it will kind of go backwards. But I do hope that people keep what they've done in their thoughts and actually, you know, even if it's not permanent, but still continue to make those small changes.
The other thing that keeps you busy, and we touched on it at the very top of the podcast, is the radio project that you're part of. What can you say about that?
So it's actually changed slightly since we first spoke. So initially, during the pandemic, I was involved in a project called Serenity Radio, and it was a wellbeing radio station that was set up basically to sort of fill a gap to support people with positive content during the pandemic. So I actually had a radio show on there once a week where I was talking about helping sort of your mental resilience, you know, and that involved everything from sort of mental toolkits through to nutrition and everything. They've decided to take a break because of all the work that was done during the pandemic. But I'm now involved in a new project, which is predominantly focusing on the aviation industry, because they've been through obviously a huge, huge plight through the pandemic. And I'm now focusing on helping the aviation industry with their mental health and wellness, and involved in a podcast, but also some sort of actual proper coaching work. But then they're actually also launching a brand new radio station called Touchdown Radio, which is for the aviation industry specifically. So I'm still keeping my radio, my radio head going.
Nice. Are you learning a lot about the aviation industry as well?
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of grown up with it in my life. My dad used to travel a lot with work when I was very young, so we would often be hopping over to America, and he lived in Taiwan for a while. So I grew up around aviation. We were always seemed to be at the airport, you know, saying goodbye to my dad or picking him up or whatever. And then my husband, when I met him, he was into sort of plane spotting, I guess you'd call it back then. But his career took him to work at places like Heathrow Airport and Abu Dhabi Airport. So I've had a real insight into aviation for a long time. But the chap that I'm working with is a pilot himself as well. So obviously, yes, I'm learning more. But yeah, just love it, because it's I think, you know, aviation and obviously hospitality are two major areas that have suffered a lot in this last year. But they're also in the aviation industry. It's a very difficult area to voice how you're feeling, because there's a lot of fear factor around potentially losing your pilot's license, whatever that might look like, because of the level of responsibility they've got. So it's a really nice area to be involved in to sort of make quite a good impact.
You mentioned, and we talked a little bit earlier about the types of hobbies that people have picked up over the last year, and the sense that people have kind of embraced mindfulness a little bit more.
Yes.
Moving forward, and again, you mentioned maybe people letting go of some of that as restrictions are lifted. What are the types of techniques that people can use to retain elements of that moving forward, and to, you know, all of the good stuff that people have picked up, those kind of good mental habits, how do you sustain them when there is change and there is excitement about living life a bit different in the future?
Yeah, I always say to people, and this, you know, this is in sort of normal times when we haven't been through something like this, but especially now, if you've got some good, you know, some good things that you've tried, whether that be yoga, meditation, exercising sort of first thing, you can still do all of these things, even as life returns to some sort of normality. But the key is to build them into your day so that it works. Because as things change, you're quite right, people will get distracted, and quite often you can completely move away from a lot of the good practices you put into place. So what I always kind of advocate is a really, really good solid foundation is starting your day with some extra time for yourself, you know, and that might be kind of getting up 20 minutes, half an hour earlier. But actually, by doing that, you then giving yourself space to, I don't know, maybe do a 10-minute meditation, do go for a run for 20 minutes, whatever that looks like for you. If we start our day with some positive mindset attributes, we're more likely to continue it because we'll then feel the benefits for the rest of the day. Whereas if we leave it till the end of the day, most chances are it's not going to happen because something will always, you know, get in the way. So definitely, if people have put in place some new habits, try and keep doing them, but doing them in a sort of a small space of time at the beginning of each day to keep them running and to then really feeling the benefits as you go through the day as well.
Amanda, time has flown. It's been fascinating talking to you. Really interesting. Thank you so much for your time. Before we go, where can people find out more about you and the work that you're doing?
Okay, so my website is nourishhealing.co.uk and I'm on social media under Nourish Healing as well. But if you're on LinkedIn, then you can just look me up under Amanda Forster Searle. And yeah, if anyone has got any questions or just wants to kind of find out more about how I could perhaps help them or their business, then just reach out. There's absolutely no obligation and I'd love to hear from them.
Amanda, thanks for your time. It's been a delight having a chat.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Music on all Somerset Stories productions is created by Jazar. You can be found at betterwithmusic.com. See you next time.